Thank you for standing by, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us Mr. Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of the event. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today on Thursday, January the 17th, the year 2013. We now pass the floor to Mr. Bornozis. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning to everyone. This is Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of today's webinar. Thank you to everyone for joining us today. I am delighted that we are adding Master Limited Partnerships to our webinar series, as this is a sector that attracts significant interest and attention. Our plan is to hold these webinars on a regular basis and help foster better understanding of MLPs by a wider investor audience. To this effect, I'm also glad to mention the launching of our newest information portal, the Capital Link Master Limited Partnerships Portal, which can be found at mlp.capitallink.com or through the URL www.capitallinkportals.com. This portal aims to aggregate a wide range of news, information, events, data, and analytical tools on all listed MLPs and aims to become a free and one-stop information source for the sector. Now, going to today's panel, I would like to thank the three MLP analysts we have with us who will share their expertise and sector insight. We have with us Heinz Howard, the Chief Investment Officer at Guzman Investment Strategies and Managing Director at Guzman & Company. We also have Michael Peterson, Managing Director of Energy Research at MLV & Company, and Ross Payne, Managing Director of Fixed Income Research at Wells Fargo Securities. They will address both today's challenges and opportunities in the MLP sector, as well as the sector outlook in 2013. Now, before we begin the webinar, I would like to remind the attendees that our webinars are for information purposes only, and Capital Link bears no responsibility for the ideas and opinions expressed. Our Q&A session will follow the webinar. Please feel free to submit questions through the special button on the event page or email them to questions@capitallink.com. You can submit a question at any time during the event. And finally, please note that this event will be made available for replay within 24 hours of this live broadcast, and it will be available on our investor portal for the MLPs, which, as I mentioned, can be found at mlp.capitallink.com. And please register for free access. And finally, last but not least, we will make available a transcript that anyone can request at no cost by sending your request to transcripts@capitallink.com. And now let's begin the webinar. The way we're going to do this, as I spoke with the three analysts, is I will address a question to each one of them. And after the person who gets the question replies, the other two can chip in and add their own comments. So I will start with Heinz. The first question is, Heinz, since the lead topic of our webinar today relates to the outlook for MLPs, while not discussing specific MLPs, can you provide us your underlying outlook for the sector in 2013 and what key drivers lead you to your conclusion? Would those factors be macro factors, the overall business growth, distribution growth, or any other factors? So what is your sector outlook for 2013?
All right. Yeah, thanks. And thank you for organizing the webinar. Happy to be a part of it. Basically, so 2013, we're off to a really good start. The Alerian MLP index is up 7.8% already as of yesterday. And you know, that's not going to be the case. It's not always going to be up every day as it has been. There's certainly going to be some periods of heightened volatility, probably driven by broad market liquidity, mini crises like we've seen, in the past few years, maybe driven by Washington, D.C. or whatever other Europe or global event might impact the markets. But the MLPs are, it looked pretty attractive. The sector has reached a size and has become diversified enough where virtually any commodity price environment, there's going to be some winners and losers. No longer the case where all MLPs are so homogeneous that they're going to be impacted in the same way by the broader market and by the fundamentals of the energy space. So the broad market factors, I think, are going to remain pretty much unchanged. Interest rates are going to stay low. high-yield, tax-deferred investments are going to remain attractive. MLPs are going to continue to push the envelope in terms of how much equity they can issue. But really, the three main factors, the only factors that impact MLP returns are your entry price, your income from distributions and distribution growth, those three things. So overall, MLPs, I believe, are poised to grow distributions by between 5 and 7%, and driven by all the capital that they've raised and invested over the last 2 years. And they carry a current yield of around 6.1%. So the primary variable that's going to affect us achieving the standard low teens value proposition that exists for MLPs is what price we're going to exit 2013 with. In other words, where will that yield be at the end of 2013? So right now it's 6.1%. We've ended ended 2012 with 6.6% yield. So if MLP's yields finish 2013 around 6%, it's going to be a very good year for the MLP sector. That would imply around 20% total return for the sector. So that's my basic outlook. I've got some intra-sector specific stuff, but maybe I'll just pass it along to my other panelists.
So Mike and Ross, if you have anything to add, please go ahead.
Sure. This is Mike speaking, and I would also like to thank everyone for their interest this morning. And Nicholas, I very much appreciate your effort in coordinating everything. I think I'll follow up a little bit with what Heinz had to say in the sense that we are no longer in a circumstance where one commodity price environment is going to shape the entire sector. We've got a fairly robust division among subsectors within MLPs. My focus is primarily on the upstream side, and the expectation in a nutshell is that I think this is going to be a stock picker's year. I don't think it's the case where we're going to see top-line commodity prices drive all boats to rise. I think it's going to be a circumstance where it's harder to separate yourself from the pack, and I think it's going to be much more of an operational focus. First, I'll address the commodity price expectations. I think what we've seen on the oil side, particularly over the last quarter or two, a fair amount of evidence in terms of supply being in excess of demand. We've seen commentary from OPEC members to that case. We've seen reductions in output from Saudi and other Gulf countries as well. I think all of that speaks to the fact that where we are now in terms of global supply of oil is such that we are going to be more heavy in terms of price if supply is left unabated. I think the other side of that, as we're all aware, is OPEC is likely to take action, and they've started into the process of adjusting their output to balance the market. As everyone's probably aware, OPEC's focus is much more on balancing inventories than price being a secondary feature. But as they do that market balancing function, I think we'll see a reduction in output. And that will likely leave us within a range on the downside of about $100 for Brent. I think on the upside, the issue that's going to continue to support both the high end for oil prices as well as volatility will be supply risk, geopolitical conflict. We've seen some news flow on that today. Natural gas, similar story, different metrics. There was a window coming into the heating season where it looked like we might turn the corner on a $4 gas market based on a unseasonably warm winter thus far. It looks again like we're going to be struggling in a $3-$3.50 kind of a price environment. I don't see a lot of upside there, at least into the next heating season. NGLs, a little bit more of a wild card, but I have a bias against the rally. We have an abundance of supply. Meeting that supply is going to be rising demand, whether that be new applications or substitution to lift market demand. But in general, I don't see any of the three primary commodities as driving top-line growth. What that leaves is execution of assets, operating cost controls, and performance. And I think that's really going to be the driver on the upstream side.
And this is Ross Payne. Thanks, guys, for putting this on. From my perspective, Really, if you look at MLPs, the last leg of growth was on the natural gas side to hook all the natural gas shales to end markets. Clearly, all of the producers are now moving towards liquids, crude first, NGL second, and that ramp up in volumes is very significant, and we view it as a very primary driver for growth in the MLP market over the next decade. Currently, the U.S. is producing 6.5 million barrels of crude a day. We're consuming 15.5 million. We just put out a report earlier this month. We expect 8.1 million barrels of production by 2015 and 10.2 by 2022, which is a decade out. So really, crude production, liquids production is really going to be the drivers of growth as we see it in the MLP space. On the NGL side, we expect NGL volumes to grow 30% over the next 3 years. So a lot of growth there, a lot of infrastructure to build. Getting these new hydrocarbons to end markets is really a growing dynamic and a very strong dynamic we see that's really going to have some long legs, you know, as much as 10 years here.
Well, thank you very much, and very, very insightful. And before I go to the next question, if you allow me to share with everyone that we have now surpassed 200 registrations for the webinar, so I'm delighted to say that. And that does not count the requests that we have for the transcript. So, again, thank you to the three of you for making this a very successful event, and, of course, to our participants for being with us. I'm going now to question number two, and, Michael, if I can direct that question to you. We saw a fairly broad sell-off in the MLPs over the last couple of months of 2012, which may have been attributed to the negotiations and potential tax ramifications from the fiscal cliff. The perception in the early going of this year, and you know, we're still 2-3 weeks young this year, seems to be that MLPs as an asset class have been spared from any potential negative legislation. So do you agree with this sentiment, or is there any potential political or any other type of overhang that could cause a repeat of the November and December sell-off at this point in the year?
Nicholas, largely I agree with what you said. I think most of the risks that we saw in the fourth quarter to the space being more of a sell-off than we saw within energy, and energy being more of a sell-off than we saw within the broader markets, is a function of the insecurity and the lack of visibility that we have in Washington. Those risks for the time being have abated somewhat. We've seen a little bit of a relief rally, I think, as a consequence of that. But the overall insecurity still remains. In thinking about Washington, someone described the process to me some years ago to say, if you really want to understand government, you first need to remove reason and accountability. And although that's said a little bit in jest, the point being, I think anything is possible. I think we could see any number of eventualities materialize in Washington. That said, my bias is that there's going to be limited to negligible impact on this space. And not necessarily because it's optimistic, but I think the two primary drivers that would materially change these businesses would be a change in the intangible drilling costs and how those are accounted for, as well as some revisitation of the partnership structure for MLPs. I don't see that either of those are likely to be affected by everything that's going on in Washington. To the first point with regard to the IDCs, I would say that from an economic perspective, that change would surely lead to higher costs. And I don't think it would take a lot of political vision to suspect that a large portion, if not all of those higher costs, would be passed through to the end consumer. That doesn't seem to be helpful from a Washington perspective. That's what gets me to think that although there might be some bluster, I don't expect anything in a final piece of legislation. The last point I would offer in terms of perspective is familiarity. The European crisis that we've now been dealing with for a number of years remains insecure. There are ever-present risks that are still out there. Fundamentals are not materially changed from the last couple of years, yet the market anxiety is moderated, and I think that's because the market has become more familiar with what the possibilities are. And so these issues will abate over time, and likely the same is true from a Washington perspective in terms of things don't happen quickly, and there's probably a lot more commentary than there will be final legislation.
Thank you. Would anyone have something to add?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I this may be some bias, but I think that MLPs are safe this year. It's consistently been a really good buying opportunity whenever, you know, the word MLP gets mentioned or partnerships get mentioned in Washington, D.C. So maybe we can expect some more volatility whenever, you know, the next round of debt negotiations or tax reform negotiations happen. And sometimes, you know, the broader market sell-offs contribute to MLP volatility, and that's just from my biased perspective. I mean, it's true that over the last few years, buying at those times has been consistently a good thing from an investor standpoint. But you know, at some point, maybe it's not a good thing. But I'm bullish and would consider any of those volatility events as a buying opportunity. So,
thank you very much, Hans. So now I'll direct the next question to Ross. Ross, you focused on fixed income, so let me go to that area. The level of interest rates has a direct impact on the capital raising, on the business growth potential, and ultimately the profitability of the MLPs. So what is your interest rate outlook for 2013 and beyond? Do you expect interest rates changing significantly, and what would that mean for the MLPs?
Our Wells Fargo economist, Sylvie, 10-year treasury will only move up to 1.9% by the end of 2013. That's relative to where we stand today at 1.86%. We're also expecting the 10-year treasury to reach 2.28 by the end of 2014. So net-net, we only see a modest increase in interest rates over the next 2 years. Demand for MLP bonds has continued to be quite robust. In 2012, MLP bonds tightened 70 basis points relative to treasuries, which is how we measure it. It modestly underperformed the BBB index only because there was strong performance from a number of financial firms that impacted our index. However, if you strip that out, MLP bonds outperformed by 8 basis points during the year. We have an overweight rating on the pipeline in MLP space for 2013 based on strong fundamentals of growing liquid infrastructure and consistent cash flow. All of those things play in quite well in the minds of bond investors. So we expect there to be a very healthy appetite for continued MLP issuance on the fixed income side. We also just generally feel that energy is going to be one of the go-to spaces within the fixed income market for investors who are looking for strong performance in a relatively weak economic environment. So we feel things are going to be go quite well on the fixed income side. We think rates are going to stay low for MLP issuers, and that should bode well for their ability to continue to raise their distributions.
Well, you know, thank you. You're very clear that you expect exactly interest rates to remain, you know, stable in the foreseeable future. But I have a question that came through, if you don't mind me asking that. And the question is, if and when interest rates start to rise, whenever they do, can MLPs shield your portfolio from interest rate risk more than a traditional fixed income product?
You know, I mean, MLPs have shielded themselves largely from interest rates rising by issuing long-term bonds, whether that be 10-year notes in the high-yield and investment-grade arenas, or 30-year notes on the investment-grade side. You know, for example, in 2012, they raised $27 billion in the bond markets, and we expect a very healthy number again in 2013. Most of the investment-grade MLPs have a large percentage of their debt already locked in with long-term bonds. And the high-yield market has really been growing aggressively in this area as well, so they're locking in to long-term rates there. So, you know, I think the MLP space is doing what they should be doing, and I think the traditional methods of raising it through the bond markets has been there for them. It's been a very attractive cost of capital for them, and I think you're just going to see more of the same in that regard.
Great, thank you. Anyone would have anything to add to that before I go to the next question? Then I'm going to Michael. Michael, you already touched upon this, you know, when we had the first question, but I'll go in it in a bit more detail. Where do you see the bigger growth potential looking ahead, downstream, midstream, or upstream? You know, as you mentioned in your statement, you see that to be a stock picker's year, and you believe that there's a secular shift underway in energy which will directly benefit the upstream MLPs. So can you elaborate on that a little bit more so we can go into the subsectors?
Sure, absolutely. Let me start by saying if I were to categorize the three segments that you mentioned, Nicholas, I would probably say in terms of aggregate growth, we would see the midstream followed by the upstream and then the downstream. In terms of percentage, given that the midstream dominates capitalization within the sector, probably as a percentage I see the upstream MLPs having a lot of growth. Now, first to the midstream, both Ross and Hines have referenced growth in terms of domestic energy production and all of the necessity for energy infrastructure that's going to be required. I think that story is well known, and it's going to be a matter of strategically addressing that growth, and I think that will largely drive the platform for midstream expansion. On the upstream MLP side, I think there's a couple of things going on, still a secular shift, but perhaps differently than what we're seeing in the midstream. If you step back and look at the entirety of energy assets, in a sense, the most appropriate assets for an E&P MLP are conservative, mature, long-lived, largely characterized as boring assets, wells that have been producing for some period of time that have a good degree of likelihood to continue producing at predictable levels, all the rest. Those are exactly the kinds of wells that don't merit a lot of return for the exploration part of exploration and production companies. Those are not high return prospects. And if we use the integrated as a proxy, the integrated oils have been very disciplined over the last number of decades in terms of how they allocate capital and how they manage their portfolios. And what we've seen is that they've jettisoned from their portfolios lower returns assets, that they've moved some refining assets out, they've moved some midstream assets out. A good deal of the midstream assets within MLPs a decade ago were owned by majors and supermajors. We've seen retail leave the portfolio. I think the next step is going to be a reevaluation within the E&P portfolio. In doing that, I think there is a large quantity of E&P assets currently held within integrateds and the large independents, which are quite appropriate for upstream MLPs. And so you kind of have a perfect storm in the circumstance that, as Ross and Hines have talked about, the demand for yield looks to be sustained into 2013 and beyond. So if the market continues to look for yield-based products like MLPs on the demand side, and the supply side is matched with material growth, if you conservatively look at the number of assets held by non-MLPs relative to the quantity of assets that would be appropriate for MLPs, you can easily find yourself to a multiple of 5 or even 10 in terms of market capitalization, suggesting that when you match that demand for yield with the supply of assets, you can see material growth across the space.
Thank you very much. Would anyone like to add to this before I move on to the next question?
Sure, I will. It's Hines. In general, when you're talking about MLP stock picking, it's about finding the big trend for any given year in the space. 2011, the big trend was large cap MLPs because of the money, big money flows into ETFs that year that followed market cap weighted indexes, and it ultimately benefited the biggest MLPs. 2012, the big trend was IPOs. It was all about, and variable distribution MLPs. It was about fresh stories, strength in the fertilizer and refining business models. So what else worked in 2012 was, you know, liquids-focused MLPs, drop-down MLPs, GPs. What didn't work was coal MLPs, and upstream MLPs didn't work too well, even though the M&A growth was really strong as a percentage of market cap. Propane MLPs did very badly, and even some gathering and processing names focused on dry gas areas did not do well. So what does that mean, you know, 2013, what's the trend that's likely to come in 2013? My take is that the GPs will continue to be a strong subsector of the MLP market, especially, you know, considering how many equity offerings they're going to have to do. Equity offerings at the MLP level lead to increased cash at the GP level. So I'm bullish on equity offerings and bullish on distribution growth. So that leads to strength for GPs. And then the upstream MLPs, I think, are going to continue to see M&A opportunities, just like Michael said, from sellers that are strapped for cash to continue their exploration. And it seems like that was a formerly the riskiest part of the MLP sector, and that has changed, I think, with the advent of variable distribution MLPs and oil field services MLPs. And I think the upstream model has been proven, and maybe you'll see some rotation into that subsector in 2013.
Thank you very much. Ross, can I go to the next question? Or?
Sure.
So the next question, actually, I meant it for Hines, and he mentioned already about the distribution growth. You mentioned that you expect in 2013 to have a distribution growth of about 6-7%, if I'm not mistaken. So I wanted you, if you can elaborate on this a little bit, and also I wanted to ask you, we have seen now less traditional MLP structures to become more prevalent in today's market, and you know that includes variable distribution payouts versus the steady payouts and potentially increasing payouts. So do you see a change in the pattern of the distributions going ahead?
I think that's probably a better one for you, yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry?
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead,
Yeah, I meant that question for Hines.
We've talked about, you know, overall as a broad look at the MLP sector, the ones that are tracked by indexes I think are going to do fine and grow at rates we've seen in the past, and it's going to be driven by the record sort of capital spending and raising over the past few years, and those capital projects are going to start to bear some fruit. In terms of your, I think your question included something about decreasing distributions. I don't see too many of those from the traditionally structured MLPs. I think there may be maybe one MLP that cuts its distribution this year. Last year we saw three MLPs cut their distribution, two in the coal space and one in the propane space. But in 2010, 2011, we saw no distribution cuts. So overall, I think MLP distributions are very safe on the traditionally structured side. The track record of the sector the last 20 years in terms of at least maintaining distributions is very good, especially when compared with stocks and REITs. And so despite their higher yields, MLP's distributions have largely been secure. So the next part of your question was variable distribution MLPs. I think it's a very interesting situation right now where the sectors that have variable distribution MLPs have had excellent fundamentals over the last few years. I don't think that's an accident in terms of when they're coming to market. But it will be very interesting to see how the MLP sector reacts when those fundamentals swing the other way. For fertilizer, you know, maybe if natural gas prices rise, you know, a lot and demand for fertilizers isn't as strong, maybe the fertilizer MLPs don't do as well. And if refining MLPs have sort of a downtrend, although structurally, fundamentally, I don't think, you know, the ones that are benefiting from cheap WTI are going to have any issues in the near term. It'll be interesting to see when they start to cut their distributions what that does to the rest of the sector. They trade at higher yields, and so the potential for a down cycle, I believe, is priced in, but there will likely be some short-term headline impact on the traditionally structured MLPs when the variable ones start to see large cuts in their distributions. And I'm looking forward to that. I think things that are not fundamental to the businesses of traditional MLPs have the potential to have short-term impacts on the values of those MLPs should be viewed as a positive, if you like those MLPs, which is something that I talked about earlier. So whether it's tax cares or headline contagion around variable distribution cuts, I think it creates opportunities to buy the ones that you like at a discount. it's that inefficiency that makes MLPs very attractive for stock pickers of MLPs. So I'm also generally a fan of variable distribution MLPs because they make it harder for the typical retail investor to follow, and that's obviously bullish for people in my line of work and for Michael and Ross as well.
Okay. Anybody would like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'll be happy to add to that. Broadly, I think the comments on variable distribution are spot on. It's always nice to accept a variable when you're at a mid-cycle or peak level. I think Hines is right in the sense we will see what the investor sentiment of some of these names will be when we get into a trough cycle environment, because undoubtedly we'll see that, whether it be the fertilizers or the refiners and what have you. Broadly speaking, this is a very attractive vehicle because of the favorable tax treatment. And in the broadest sense, stable cash-generating businesses are appropriate. And I think as the market pushes the envelope as to what is suitable for this type of a structure, unfortunately, and just as a function of the pendulum overshooting, I think we're going to have to see the market push some number of issues to the breaking point before we can come to some certainty as to what is or isn't appropriate. There are things that I certainly have less comfort with because of their underlying businesses and their cash-generating assets. There have been, in that same light, some amount of discussion and interest in terms of opening up the MLP to green energy and new technologies. And I think in terms of championing energy efficiencies and those new technologies, there are probably a number of appropriate venues that you could look to. I don't know that the MLP structure is it. These are not necessarily industries that are high cash generating industries that have predictable, mature business lines. I don't know that those are going to be successful endeavors. But I think what we're going to see is the market kind of adjudicate that. We've seen a little bit of volatility in ideas that were perhaps well conceived but haven't been executed properly, and others that maybe just aren't appropriate. The last point that I would offer is that the real attraction from an investor standpoint to the MLP is the yield, as we all know. They're buying a yield, and they've shown a good degree of flexibility over the last number of years in terms of expanding their horizons for the types of venues that they think are potentially appropriate in terms of a pool of assets. On the other side of things, I would argue that most of the assets that we're talking about are being sold. And by that, I think there was a downstream issuance that just happened in the last day or so. That was an asset that was repurposed and sold back into the market. The attractiveness of selling that asset was because of the MLP structure and the demand. And I think really adjudicating the fundamentals and what the earnings power of some of these issues will be will solve the problem in terms of which issues are appropriate, what types of assets are appropriate, and which maybe by way of experience are not.
Well, Michael, actually, you led me to the next question that I intended to ask you, and it's exactly on the topics that you have already started discussing. We have seen now, you know, new sectors, new types of businesses coming into the MLP space, and you know, we have seen oil field services, fertilizers. There has been discussion of expanding the MLP concept to include water handling assets, alternative green energy companies, and so on. So the question that I wanted to ask you, and you've already touched upon that, but maybe to reiterate it, what are the typical characteristics of a business that would make it conducive to be an MLP? And do you see any other new types of businesses that are close now to becoming more prevalent as a new type of MLP?
Probably the one key characteristic of a business, and I did mention this before, is cash generation. The distribution model doesn't work for businesses that don't have a fair amount of cash from operations. And some of the businesses that you mentioned, fertilizers in a good part of the cycle, are cash rich. In other times, they are not. And I think a variable distribution for cyclical types of markets may be the answer. From my perspective as an analyst, not having the visibility in a cyclical business that you would in a more perpetual business limits the multiple and the uplift that you might get for purposing those assets into this type of a structure. Not inappropriate, but you're going to be received on the market slightly differently. I would say some of the other items that you mentioned in terms of what might be very meritorious ideas for types of industries and companies don't necessarily fit this mold. Because they don't, I think pushing the envelope in that way may not be as helpful to investors. Does that speak to what you want? Is there something else you'd like me to elaborate on, Nicholas?
You're absolutely right, and I think at the end of the day, businesses look at the MLP space as a space that attracts a lot of investor interest. So they would like to have their business qualify as an MLP and float it as an MLP. I guess it's up to the bankers, to the analysts, and so on to discuss with those businesses and tell them that maybe, they're not the perfect prototype of an MLP.
Exactly. Businesses that don't have a good deal of forward visibility of earnings and cash generation may be challenged in this structure.
Because at the end of the day, I think, as you mentioned, investors are buying into the MLPs for the yield and hopefully for the total return if they see some capital appreciation in the unit. But it's the stability of the distribution that makes it so attractive. Anyway, I'm not the analyst. So going to the next question, Ross, if I can ask you, going to the capital raising is critical for the long-term success of any MLP. So since you focus on the fixed income, can you please share with us how you expect the bond raising activity of MLPs looking ahead? What types of credit ratings and spreads are we likely to see?
Okay, sure. As a general rule within the MLP space, most organic or acquisition financing is typically done approximately 50% bonds, 50% equity in order to maintain appropriate leverage metrics for the rating agencies. From a bond perspective, the average bond yield for investment grade right now is 3.32%, which offers MLPs a very attractive cost of capital on the debt side. Last year, MLPs across the board, both high yield and investment grade, raised $27 billion in the bond market. Bond markets, we expect a very healthy level to that in 2013 as well. From a credit rating perspective, we've seen the larger investment grade MLPs improve their ratings. Typically, it used to be low triple B for investment grade rated MLPs. We've seen a number of MLPs move up into the mid-triple range and even beyond positive outlook for high triple. And that's been encouraging, and I think that's been a function of good performance, consistent cash flows, good-looking balance sheets, and size, frankly. On the high-yield side, we've also seen a lot of smaller MLPs move up in the ratings as well as they've gotten larger, more diversification, et cetera. We have seen some isolated instances of ratings downgrades, and we even had an investment grade entity go to non-investment grade, and that was it's been a very rare occurrence in our market, but it did occur this year. Now, when you also look at spreads of bonds over treasuries, levels are very attractive. On the investment grade front, issuance is now occurring kind of in the mid-threes to high-three range for 10-year bonds for investment grade companies. On the 30-year front, we're seeing it in the high-threes, low-fours. And then on the high-yield front, issuance has really been kind of in the high 4% range and low 5% range for 10-year notes. But either looking at investment grade or high yield, either of these ranges is quite attractive to the MLP space. And finally, we expect bond spreads relative to treasuries to kind of stay flat in 2013 relative to where we just ended the year. So cost of capital net-net is going to be very reasonable for the space.
And can I ask you, in terms of the average maturity or the usual maturity, these bonds, they are 5 years, 10 years, longer?
You know, in the investment grade arena, I'd say the average the average tenure, if you will, is probably around 7 to 7.5 years. On the high yield front, I don't have that data in front of me. I would guess it'd be kind of 4.5 to 6, somewhere in there. And the reason for that on the high yield side is issuance has really grown dramatically in the last 18 to 24 months. So it's impacted the space in a pretty big way. But I'd say generally, you know, so those are not, those are fairly healthy levels. And on the investment grade side, we're continuing to see MLPs put additional capital in the 30-year end of the curve, giving perceptions that we're near the bottom in interest rates in this particular cycle. But average tenures are long for almost all companies, and that gives them a lot of breathing room. Even if interest rates start to rise, they'll continue to issue at slightly higher rates. We think the spreads, again, will stay relatively consistent to where they are today. So if you go from a 1.9% 10-year bond to a 2.5% 10-year bond, you know, the rates that these MLPs will be paying is not going to grow much more than you'll see the Treasury rise.
Thank you very much. And now I'll move from the bond side to the equity side. And Hines, let's focus on the IPO market. I'll use data that actually you were kind to provide me. The MLP capital raising activity has been rather brisk, I would say, in the last few years. Just focusing on the IPOs, in 2011 we had 13 IPOs raising $2.7 billion. In 2012, again, we had another 13 IPOs raising $3.7 billion. And so far, in the 3 weeks in 2013, we have two IPOs raising about $800 million. So it seems we are off to a good start. Now, looking ahead, what is your outlook in terms of new IPOs in the market and capital raising?
Yeah, sure. I think we've got one more pricing this week. So by the end of this week, we'll have three IPOs in the first 3 weeks of the year, all pricing this week. I don't think that's ever happened, both the activity so early in the year and all happening in 1 week. So whatever that means, we'll see. But we've had one, and we've also had one new IPO added to the pipeline with New Source Energy filing a few weeks ago. So that makes six MLPs on file, all of them of the non-traditional variety, including two upstream MLPs. And five of those haven't updated their S-1 since July of 2012. Two of them are coal MLPs, which likely wouldn't want to go public, you know, in the current market for coal. So the IPO market is robust in terms of it's wide open, demand is there. You know, I think we had the largest MLP IPO ever, $600 million last night. But there aren't nearly as many IPOs on file as there were sort of midway through 2012 when we had as many as 15 IPOs on file. So I expect to see more file and more go public, but after the nearly 30 MLP IPOs we've seen in 2 years, I don't expect to see as many as we've seen in the past 2 years. And a lot of that is going to be driven by private equity firms and the timing around them exiting, because more and more of these MLPs that are coming to market are private equity-backed companies that are trying to shoehorn their oil field services or what have you investment into an MLP. And so timing of those exits is difficult in terms of trying to gauge when they'll come to market. I do think because of one particular IPO that we'll see another large publicly traded corporation file for an MLP. I think the GP IPO of Western Gas's GP that was so very successful, I think that will convince at least one other company that had previously, I mean, what you hear from the larger companies that are public about when they're asked about MLPs is, oh, it doesn't move the needle. But I think what Western Gas proved is, you know, in 4 years they created, I think it was $2.7 billion of value just from the incentive of distribution rights cash flow. And so I think that will convince at least one large, you know, whether it be a major or slightly smaller company to launch an MLP as a subsidiary IPO. So we'll see. I don't think we'll see as much oilfield services as we would have seen if High Crush IPO didn't have some struggles out of the gate. I think, but you know, that remains to be seen as well. So that's my general take, less than last year, but still, you know, robust.
Thank you. I'd like to remind our participants that they can submit questions at any time. Either you can click on the button that says submit a question on your screen, or you can email them to us at questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. And I have a number of questions that have come in. Some of them I've already asked you, and here are a few more. One of them is, what are you seeing in the GP space as opposed to the to LPs, to limited partners? Are there attractive catalysts or relative valuation trends to watch for within the GP space? I don't know who would like to take that. So if I can have one of you, is it a difficult question?
This is Mike Nicholas. That's going to be tough for me in that I don't have GPs under coverage, and I would suspect that probably the primary catalyst relative to the underlying business that you would look to for the LP equity would be where you are in terms of your distribution breakpoints and what some of the incremental opportunities are, in the same way that we would look for an acceleration of earnings and distribution and everything else as a function of the underlying businesses for the LP. The GP, I think the real incremental gains will be from achieving those various breakpoints and seeing an acceleration or a wider piece of the incremental pie at various points. I think that would probably be the most instructive. The last thing I would suggest is when you're looking at a mature entity, we've seen over time that some of the mature entities have gone back and restructured their GP IDRs to again provide them with running room and forward incentives. I think that could be another value-based opportunity for a GP to see an outsized bump in a kind of a nonlinear fashion.
Thank you very much. And now another question, Heinz, maybe I can send that question to you, please. Why haven't more major oil companies launched MLPs?
Yeah, I think I touched on that in my last answer, but it's...
Typically
viewed it as something that doesn't move the needle very much. You know, that if you're talking about a company that has, you know, $100 billion of market cap or $200 billion of market cap, launching, you know, a tiny MLP, you know, like I said, the largest one was $600 million of, you know, at an IPO. So, you know, you're talking about maybe something that has a enterprise value of $2 billion at IPO. So I think that's been the biggest case. It doesn't move the needle. It's too much work for not enough reward. And I think Anadarko has proven that with a plan and with a strategy, you can create value with the MLP structure through the incentive distribution rights that can be worth it. Like I said, I think 4 years it took Anadarko to develop their GP before they took it public, and when they did, you know, the GP was worth, I want to say, 2.7 billion. I can get the actual number, but let's see, it was worth 2.5 billion at IPO, and then, you know, a few days later, their value of their GP interest and their IDRs is worth $3.8 billion. And so I think someone will take a look at that and say, you know, this could be worth it. And we can. And the other thing that they say is, you know, we'd like to maintain control of our assets, which is kind of a throwaway thing to say on a conference call, because when you launch an MLP subsidiary, you do control the assets. It's just through, you know, a different partnership, but you're the GP. And so I think. Those two reasons that they often list have been dispelled, and we may see a large company launch one. It would sure, I mean, as evidenced by the Marathon IPO, you know, a good name brand and some quality assets can really do wonders for your IPO yield. I think that was the lowest ever MLP IPO yield for something that was not a general partner in 2012. So it's an attractive sort of option for a large major oil company.
Nicholas, this is Mike. If I can add two points to what Heinz just said, I think there are two things that are instructive, and he touched on one of them, which is both with Marathon as well as Conoco, as integrated entities, they had long shunned the MLP structure. Now that they've divided themselves up and are large cap independents, both are pursuing an MLP platform. And so I think that's instructive. I also think it's worthwhile to look at the experience that Chevron had when they acquired Atlas. Atlas had a shared drilling partnership business that Chevron decidedly didn't want anything to do with, and that's been the core of the second iteration of the Atlas Resource Partners entity. When you think about the large cap integrateds in particular, among the last things that they have an interest in is having a host of retail partners to their business. These are companies that have spent decades trying to shield the internals of their business from international host states and other types of things. And so opening their books to a partnership is not likely something that they're going to consider anytime soon. But if those assets were repurposed or jettisoned to another entity where the large cap or the integrated was not the GP, then I think you'd see a lot of opportunity there. And I think we're seeing that using the Marathon and Conoco examples.
I see. Thank you very much. Well, I have another question. I don't know if you would like to take it yourself, about the refiners. We touched upon that in the previous conversation, but I have a question that someone would like to focus specifically on the refiners. What's the outlook on them?
I think what we've seen with the disconnect between Brent and WTI has been certainly a terrific window for MidCon refiners to refine a stranded, discounted feedstock and sell into a product market that is undersupplied within the mid-continent of the U.S. Therefore, the market clearing price for gasoline and diesel and most everything else on the product side in the middle of the country are incremental imports that come from the coasts. Those coastal products are set at Brent feedstock prices. And so you've had a terrific window of opportunity for good margins. I think we've also seen, as a result of the insurrection that happened in Libya and the drawdown of European inventories, namely European distillates and diesel inventories, waterborne crack spreads have been certainly above mid-cycle levels. And where I'm headed with all of this is I think we've had a very good environment for refiners in the last 12 and 24 months. I don't have a high degree of confidence that this is a normal environment, but rather an elevated environment. And so I think we'll start to see, going forward, more compression within refining margins, and there'll be more challenges, as we saw, you know, 3 or 4 years ago within refiners. A variable distribution, I think, does address that. If we're talking about something that's not a variable distribution, I think you're very challenged, in part because hedging refining is even more challenging than just hedging products at various basis points.
And one more question I wanted to ask you. Any particular trends in terms of the research coverage on research coverage of the MLP space? Do you see any more players coming in? Do you see the research coverage expanding?
Is that for me, Nicholas?
Well, any of the three who would like to respond?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you that Guzman & Company is going to launch equity research hopefully at the end of this month, as fast as I can produce reports. We're going to launch on the upstream space first, and then maybe into the GP. So as I mentioned, those are the two things that I think are going to be most active and most interesting in the next few years. I mean, a few months, I guess, the rest of this year. And so we're launching on 5 upstream MLPs towards the end of this month, and you know, we'll take it from there.
Okay. Anyone else would like to say something? I think we are almost at 55 minutes. We had a very interesting discussion. I would like to thank you very much for your contribution to today's webinar. We had well over 200 participants, not counting the transcript requests. So I think we can claim success. But above all, I think it has been a very, very interesting discussion, very enlightening. And unless you would like to add something, I will bring our webinar to a close. So thank you very much to all three of you for participating. I hope we can do that again. And with this, I will call it a day and thank everyone. And I'd like to remind everybody that we have an audio replay. This webinar will be available as an archive on the website, and there's a transcript that anyone can request at no cost. Again, thank you, and we can all hang up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That just concludes our webinar for today. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.